to Hotel Bar Sessions, the podcast where three philosophers sit down at the end of a long conference day to chop it up at the hotel bar, which, as we all know, is where the real philosophy happens.
Welcome back to Hotel Bar Sessions. I'm Jason Reed, and I'm joined with Rick Lee and Lee Johnson. This week, we're talking about bad faith. Before we get to that, let's get our drink orders and rants and raves in. So, Rick, what are you having and what are you ranting or raving about?
I am going to have a Manhattan with rye, please. Today, I am ranting about the new form of I'm just asking. Because I'm not on social media, maybe you've all known this for a long time. But apparently, with all the disasters Boeing has been going through, people are just asking on Fox News and other places whether DEI has anything to do with this. It came up again in relation to the boat crashing into the bridge in Baltimore. The mayor of Baltimore is African American, and people are just asking whether DEI has anything to do with it. Forget the fact that the mayor was not driving the ship, that the mayor was not on the bridge, that the mayor, in fact, was at home tending to a child at 3 a.m. But somehow the fact that he's African American leads to a boat crashing into the bridge. It's just fucking unbelievable.
Yeah. And if you've somehow not learned this already, DEI stands for diversity, equity, and inclusion. It's what gets blamed for. Well, it gets blamed for a lot.
As I said in the movie Terminator, it's a perfect conspiracy theory because it doesn't require a shred of proof. Almost every company has a DEI initiative, so when anything goes wrong, you can always point to it.
Right, and the I'm just asking is a way of getting something on the table without taking ownership of it. It's cowardly and it's bullshit.
So Lee, what are you having and what are you ranting or raving about?
I think I'm going to have a margarita today, and I'm raving about the open source nerds who keep the internet running. So back in late March, there was a bug introduced by a persona on the internet named Giaton called the XZ bug. And if it had been distributed widely, it would have been able to get into a kind of security backdoor in the Linux systems that control a lot of the servers that power the internet. Fortunately, someone caught it ahead of time, so not too much damage was done. But I think the lesson of the story here is that open source code is provided by, you know, basically nerds who volunteer their time to make the internet work and to maintain open source libraries for the internet to work. And it turns out that XZutils, which would have provided the backdoor for this malicious code, is actually controlled by only one guy. And that may seem like a terrible idea. Like, why does only one guy control this? But that's how open source code works. You know, somebody raises their hand and says, look, I'll do this. I'll take care of this. I think the other lesson to take from this is that this guy, or, well, we don't know who it is, this persona, Giaton, who introduced the malicious code, this had to have been a long play for him, right? He had to have earned the trust of that community in order to eventually introduce this code. I mean, he was working in open source code for like 2 years and had done a lot of really good work. And so people trusted him and therefore probably didn't double check some of the things that he did. And that's how he got this malicious backdoor code in. These open source nerds get no thanks. We all depend on them. So I'm raving about them today. Jason, what about you? What are you drinking and what are you ranting or raving about?
I'm going to have a Bundaberg ginger beer. It's a new ginger beer I just discovered. And I am raving about Children of Time by Adrian Tchaikovsky. Recently, here in Portland, Maine, a lot of us, myself included, lost power for a sustained period of time because of an ice storm. And so I was cut off from technology and the work I should have been doing, which is grading. And I delved into Children of Time, which is an amazing science fiction novel by Adrian Tchaikovsky. It's first of a trilogy. And I have a love-hate relationship with science fiction trilogies. Even when they're good, they always feel like such a time commitment. But this book is amazing. It has great stuff about animal intelligence, specifically spiders. It has great stuff about religion, about artificial intelligence, about technology and our dependence on it. If the rest of the books are as good as this, it's an amazing series. So, Rick, we're talking about bad faith. What's bad faith and where does it come from?
Well, I was hoping you all would help me figure that out. But today is our last episode of season 9. And as is our custom, we are turning to a particular text or argument or concept in the history of philosophy. And today we're turning to the concept of bad faith, which comes up in the book Being and Nothingness by Jean-Paul Sartre in his analysis of consciousness. So today we're going to take a deep dive into a section from Being and Nothingness on bad faith.
So I think before we jump into the patterns of bad faith section from Sartre's Being and Nothingness, it might be helpful just to kind of set the stage for why he's even talking about this thing, bad faith. This is going to involve a little bit of technical language, but I think it's easily understandable. One of the things that Sartre does in the sections leading up to bad faith is he separates two kinds of beings in the world. So on the one hand, we have what he calls beings in themselves. For the most part, everything except for us, right? Rocks, trees, tables and chairs.
The famous tables and chairs.
Importantly, tables and chairs. And then there are beings for themselves, which is only us, human beings. The main difference between a being in itself and a being for itself is that a being in itself, for Sartre, is defined entirely by what he calls its facticity. You could imagine this as what is given in its very existence. Mm. So, for example, in order for a table to exist, certain things have to be given in its existence. It has to be flat, it has to have legs, you have to be able to put things on it. And, you know, although there are some accidental characteristics of tables that can change, you know, they can be different color, they can be made of different material, if certain essential facts change, they would be something different. I mean, my table can be green instead of brown, but if it starts growing fur and meowing, it is not a table anymore. So that's what a being in itself is. Everything about it has to be given in its very existence. Now, contrast that with the kinds of beings that we are, which are beings for themselves. Sartre says, although it is the case that we are to some extent also defined by facticity, by the givenness of our existence, by the givenness of our situation, it's a very different sort of restriction for us than it is for other things. Like, for example, I can change a lot of things about myself. I'm not entirely determined by the facts that were given in my existence, and I always find myself in situations in which I have to make choices, transcend in a way the givenness of that situation to do something different. So Sartre says beings for themselves, beings like us, are defined both by facticity and transcendence. And here we can just hear transcendence as another word for freedom. So given that distinction, Sartre says, look at us, we're very weird kinds of beings. And because we're always in this sort of metastable existence, waffling back and forth between the givenness of our existence and our free choices to transcend the givens, we sometimes fall into what he calls patterns of bad faith. So we haven't yet said what bad faith is, but I just wanted to set the stage for like why we're even talking about it.
Leah, you pointed out something in situating bad faith within the text that I think is really important, and that is in this freedom that belongs to beings like us, there's also a kind of making, right? That we are beings who, in a way, make our own being.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the freedom that you were pointing to. I think that making one's own being is in one way central to this question of bad faith, because I could make myself in all sorts of different ways, and bad faith is one of the ways in which I can make myself. So I really appreciate your pointing out this constructivity or making that belongs also to freedom.
Yeah, and that gets at something that is also really important in Sartre's distinguishing between these two kinds of beings, the being in itself and the being for itself. You know, before a table is made, comes into existence, the table maker has an idea of what the table is, essentially what the table is, and then brings that into existence, you know, makes it given in the world. And so Sartre says, for beings in themselves, their essence precedes their existence. However, for beings like you and I, this is how I explain it to my students, you know, there is no possible way that your parents could have known who you are now prior to your existence. As Sartre says, we're born into the world and we're condemned to be free. Who you are now, your essence, and I'm sort of putting that in scare quotes, but your essence is a consequence of a billion decisions, free decisions that you've made since you were born. So again, for Sartre, unlike a being in itself, a being for itself, its existence precedes its essence. So yeah, it is all about the making of ourselves, the becoming who we are.
Right. So you're saying my parents didn't realize I would be a podcaster?
Although parents don't control what we become, but parents do put a lot of effort in trying to make us into projects like Tables.
And not podcasters.
And not podcasters.
So if it's okay, let's just jump on into Bad Faith.
Yeah.
Because Sartre is describing what he sees as a necessary pattern that beings like us have a tendency to fall into in the course of being for ourselves, becoming who we are, making who we are. I like the way that you said that, Rick. So the straightforward definition of bad faith, according to Sartre, is a lie to oneself. And I think what we're going to see is that the structure of the lie is always the same, despite the fact that the content of the lie differs in the many examples he gives us of bad faith. Before we go into those examples or examples of those patterns, I do want to stop for 1 second, though, and talk about this idea of lying to yourself.
Yeah.
I know that we've talked about this on the podcast before. You guys know that I hate this. I hate this idea of lying to yourself, not because I don't think it's real, but because I think that it's too easily mistaken as a analog to lying to someone else.
Well, and Sartre is quick to point out the difference between lying to oneself and lying to another.
Right.
And this goes back to the, I don't want to say duality because Sartre is not a dualist, but the twofoldness of our being, namely that we do have this element of being in itself. There's a there-ness, a facticity to it, but also a being for itself. There's the freedom and the making. When I lie to someone else, that other is for me a mere being in itself.
Right.
That other is a thing-like entity, like a table or a famous chair. But when I lie to myself, that twofold character is involved. And so I'm treating myself as if I were a being in itself, but at the same time, I'm a being for itself. And so there's a kind of cycle here or a feedback loop that really differentiates lying to another from lying to myself. In a way, I think Sartre is saying, I lie to myself and therefore I make the lie impossible. The very act of it also is the impossibility of the act of it.
Yeah. I mean, if we could just pick a random, this is not going to be random at all, but lie that one tells oneself, like, I'm just going to stay for one drink. I mean, if I say to you, I'm just going to stay for one drink and I mean to deceive you, then I'm lying to you, right? I have the truth. You don't have the truth. I've given you a lie instead of the truth. If I say that to myself, it's harder to explain because if I say that to myself, I'm in some way involving a description of myself in the future, a future that hasn't happened yet, and a future that's going to require a lot of decisions, a lot of transcending of whatever my given situation is. And I think this gets back to, by the way, why the book is called Being and Nothingness, because Sartre believes that in our consciousness, in our very being, nothingness, as he says, sleeps at its heart like a worm. So there's always this sense in which I'm becoming who I am. I never just simply am who I am, like a table or a chair. I'm always reaching to something that I'm not yet. And in that sense, I lie to myself.
Mm-hmm. And I think this gets to an important point that you raised before, but now we begin to see the importance of it, that because we are beings that make choices, we have projects, as Sartre says, and therefore there's a kind of openness to the future. If Sartre wants to say that really we are beings that are always becoming, then we are beings who are always not yet what they will be, and therefore there's a negativity built into the very things we are. And that means that bad faith is a possibility we can't get rid of because we are the beings we are. Because we're the beings we are, bad faith is an always present possibility.
Yes, exactly.
It's not a mistake or something totally outside of what it is to be human. It belongs to the very heart of what it is to be human.
It's also not always a moral failure. And I want to get to that later, but I just think it's important to point out right here at the beginning. Mm.
Your example, you know, just staying for one drink, also raises, I think, the question of where does time and temporality fit into all of this? Mm-hmm. It also connects to, and I'm sure we'll get into this later, the examples that Sartre gives. One example being the bad date. The woman in question is perfectly content to be on that date. She just doesn't want it to be caught up into any larger project that has a telos to it, right? I mean, to me, the just staying for one drink is often a thing I tell myself, and I mean it, and I believe it in the moment. And then if later people are like, you said you're just going to stay for one drink, I was like, well, the conversation, like someone brought up the Planet of the Apes films, and I had to be there for that. You know, like I didn't know that was where things were going to go or something to that effect. So I guess what I'm thinking about is how to think about our relationship to transformation brought about, not just through our own freedom, but the way in which time has its own way of altering the given facticity of a certain situation.
I think that's a really nice way to put it, Jason. One of the things to keep in mind, though, is that when I say I'm going out with you guys tonight, I'm just going to stay for one drink, whether or not I stay for one drink has absolutely nothing to do with whether or not that is a lie to myself.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The lie that I'm telling myself is that in the future, I will be what I am in the same way that I am what I am now. Mm-hmm. Period. Mm. Right? It would be like, I mean, sorry, but the table saying, I'm just going to stay for one drink tonight, or I'm just going to have four legs tonight. Like, that's, of course, not an issue because the table has no capacity to transcend the givenness of its existence. Because I do, I am capable of pretending as if my being is the being of a table or an object. Mm-hmm.
And part of that transcending, and this goes back to the example of the bad date, and even with the drink, I'm only going to stay for one drink. I say that as if I am separate from my body and from my embodiment. Ooh. That although you might start talking about Planet of the Apes, and so I'm drawn to stay for that conversation, I am somehow able to get outside of that and make decisions independent of that. Again, I think, Lee, this goes back to whether or not, in fact, I am able to do that in the end doesn't matter to the structure of what's going on when I say I'm only going to stay for one drink. In saying that, I'm acting as if I am somehow different from my body, or as I think Sartre puts it in this section, I consider my body as a being in itself and somehow therefore different from me, who is a being for itself.
Yeah. I think it's also the case, though, that what you think you're doing is you think that you're declaring something like the essence of who you are. Mm. And on Sartre's account, we don't have an essence. Or if we do have an essence, our essence is freedom. And that's a really weird kind of essence.
Right.
I sometimes tell my students, they don't know this reference, but, you know, the old Popeye saying, I am what I am, and that's all that I am. That is never true of a human being.
Yeah, and this goes back to the negativity. If I am always becoming, and therefore freedom is central to what I am, then I am always what I am not because of that becoming.
Yeah, and he uses that turn of phrase a lot, being what you are in the mode of not being.
Right. Exactly.
You know what would really suck right now? A commercial. Imagine the witty and entertaining philosophical banter being interrupted with an ad from MailChimp. Terrible. You can help us keep ad-free and free by supporting us with a donation. You can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/hotelbarsessions. Where you can sign up to make a monthly donation at several different levels. Or, if you'd prefer a one-time donation, or to make sporadic gifts when you're able, just visit our website, hotelbarpodcast.com, You can find links to support the podcast through Venmo, PayPal, or Cash App. Now back to the interesting stuff.
Well, let's go ahead and jump into some of the examples of patterns of bad faith that Jean-Paul Sartre provides. This is one of the things I really love about Jean-Paul Sartre, is he gives really rich examples. And probably the most famous example of patterns of bad faith is Sartre's story about the garçon du café, the waiter in the café. Mm-hmm. Basically, it goes like this. Actually, let me back up a second, because Sartre's, of course, writing this in mid-century Paris. So everybody's hanging out in the cafes. If somebody said, you know, you're acting like a waiter in a cafe, that would have been a reference that was very familiar to everyone. But since that's not really how cafes work today, I'm going to change up the story a little bit. We're going to have a waiter in an Applebee's. Okay. So listeners, I'm going to ask you to imagine an Applebee's waiter.
By the way, isn't Applebee's as such bad faith?
Touche. Okay. Imagine an Applebee's waiter. Now think, what does he look like? What's his name? How does he act? How does he move? The fact is that if you've ever been to an Applebee's or a Chili's or, you know, any of those sorts of restaurants, you've got it in your head, right? There's this guy, his name's whatever, Kyle. He's got, you know, a little bit of a scruffy beard. He's probably in his mid-20s. He's wearing slacks and black tennis shoes and an apron, et cetera, et cetera. He comes over, he squats down at your table, and he's like, hey guys, how we doing? Can we start you off with some appetizers or something to drink? And you can describe exactly the essence of this Applebee's waiter. Now, imagine that you were his friend. You came into the restaurant. You're sort of watching him work, and you're noticing this. You're noticing that he's got these clothes on, that he moves in a certain way, that he approaches people in a certain way, that he's a little too solicitous, that he's a little too friendly, he's a little too peppy. And you think to yourself, this is not how Kyle is in the real world. Why is he acting like this? If you went up to him and said, Kyle, WTF, man. Like, why are you wearing those clothes? Why are you acting like that? This is not how you are. What are you doing? Why are you acting like this? He would probably say, because I have to. Mm. You know, it's my job. I got to pay the rent.
Right.
I'm trying to make tips, whatever. Sartre is going to say that what Kyle is saying there, what the Applebee's waiter is saying there, is that he is a waiter like a table is a table.
Right.
That he has no choice at all in what he is, what he's doing. But even as those words come out of his mouth, he knows that he woke up this morning, he put on those clothes, he drove to Applebee's, he's the one that upsold appetizers. He is freely making all of these decisions, and that he could have made literally infinitely other decisions, that he's so free, you know, that the explanation, I have to do this, is almost laughable. So the lie that he's telling himself is that he is not a freedom, that he is just a being in itself, a waiter the same way a table is a table.
I think it's too easy to jump outside of Kyle and look at it from a social perspective or the perspective of another individual. But the structure of bad faith is we have to look at it from Kyle's perspective or from my perspective if I am a waiter. We could say, well, he has the role of a server in a restaurant is a role of emotional labor, and that's a role given by society, and so its rigidity comes from there. Yes, that's all probably true. But I think, Lee, what you were pointing out in your description is, what is Kyle doing internally to Kyle when he says, it's my job, it's what I have to do? That's where bad faith comes up.
Right. Because he doesn't have to do it.
Because he doesn't have
to. Yes, right. Of course, the roles of this job are socially constructed and imposed on him. But he doesn't have to be a waiter. He doesn't have to be a good waiter. He could be a shitty waiter. He's making choices, and he's, as Sartre says, fleeing his freedom in saying, I'm not making choices.
Well, he does have to sell his wage labor in order to survive in a capitalist society.
Okay, so I didn't want to go here immediately, but no, he doesn't, right? I mean, he could choose to starve to death. Okay, so trigger warning, listeners, this is something that comes up again and again and again in Sartre's discussion of freedom. Sartre does say, as long as you're alive, you are never not free. And that means that at the very least, you have the freedom to end your life. So even if we said that, well, he does at least have to survive. Well, no, he doesn't. That's a free choice. Hopefully it is a free choice that we make every day, but it is still a free choice.
That shows you at one and the same time how expansive Sartre's notion of freedom is. And also perhaps because it's so expansive, at certain moments it becomes somewhat empty, maybe. Mm-hmm. It might mean simply, to paraphrase Albert Camus, that the only real decision or the most fundamental decision is whether or not to kill oneself.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think you're right, Lee, that freedom is infinite. That infinity of the freedom is predicated on the fact that this is a decision that I could always opt for.
This may be a ticky-tack point, but instead of saying the freedom is infinite, I would say, along with Sartre, that the freedom is absolute.
Nice.
And to say that I have absolute freedom is, of course, not to say I can do anything I want.
Right.
I obviously can't do anything I want. I can't time travel. I can't fly. There are all kinds of things that I cannot do. All it means is that there's no point at which I am not free. My freedom is absolute in that sense. I always have a choice to make.
Yeah, I like mm-hmm. that.
I say that a little bit for our professional philosophy listeners, because this is like one of my biggest peeves about when people talk about Sartre and they say, oh, he believes in absolute freedom. And they mean that you can do whatever you want. He literally says, that's not what I mean by absolute freedom.
Right. Yeah. I mean, in a way, the medieval philosopher Duns Scotus talks about the human will as absolute in the terms you're talking about. And he says that, for example, if I'm falling off a 10-story tower, I can will that I'm not falling. And the fact that I can't stop falling does not impact the absolute nature of the will.
Yeah. I mean, if you're in a prison cell and chained and blindfolded and like imagine the most unfree situation that you can imagine, you're still free to, I don't know, plot your escape, right?
No.
Like miss your mother, fall into despair. That is, I don't think an empty sense of freedom. I think it's an important sense of freedom, but it's obviously, you know, depressing. I mean, it's anxiety producing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a freedom that makes its most manifest appearance in suicide itself. And in some sense, it's very different from freedom conventionally understood is the ability to do whatever you want. It's more you always have the freedom to say no to whatever is imposed upon you.
See, I would disagree. And this is maybe where I find Sartre more optimistic than anxiety producing. I don't think it's the freedom to choose suicide. I think it's the fact that every day you get up and have the freedom to choose life, to choose Applebee's.
That's depressing.
Yeah, where's the optimism, Lee?
But let's go back to the waiter for a second. Let's go back to Kyle. Because ultimately, Sartre wants us to ask, why is he saying this? Why is he saying that he's a waiter, like a table is a table? I don't think he's criticizing the fact that we all play roles.
Right.
You know, I tell my students this in class all the time when we're talking about Sartre. I say, right now, you're acting at being a student. I'm acting at being a professor. This is not how we are in our normal day lives. You know, you're sort of being a student like a table is a table. I'm being a professor like a table is a table. That's just how we have to get along with one another. The problem is when you say, I have to do this. I have no other choice. I am a student like a table is a table, or I am a professor like a table is a table. We are not. You know, I say to my students, you can get up and walk out right now. You can quit college. You can go work at Applebee's. It's a choice. It's a freedom that you have. So why is he telling this lie to himself?
Well, part of it goes back to this issue of anxiety, that in some sense, if I weren't being a waiter as a table is a table, I'm now thrown back on a realm of possibilities that is vertiginous. It can make your head spin. In a sense, I think you were going there, Lee. Just in order to get by and survive, I need to act as if I'm a professor in the way that a table is a table. Because if not, then what? Possibilities, the limits of which I cannot see.
That's one aspect of the vertiginous nature of, like, well, let's call it a confrontation with your absolute freedom. That's one, is that like, oh, there's so many choices. There's so many other choices that I could be making. Every time I say yes to one thing, I'm saying no to literally everything else. There's so many other things that I could be saying yes to. That's one aspect of it. But the other aspect of it is, I have to take responsibility for the choices that I have made. Mm. I don't just have to be this way.
Right.
You know, I can make different choices. And that is also, according to existentialism in general, as a philosophy, that's part of our angst-ridden existence. Mm. We flee our freedom because we flee our responsibility.
Can I ask a question about the waiter example? Because I do feel like, I mean, as you said, Sartre probably picked this because he may have been sitting at a cafe when he wrote it, looked up, and was like, what's an example of, that guy.
Yeah.
So waiter. And it kind of calls back to a sort of Parisian cafe culture. But I think it plays differently now because a waiter in contemporary parlance is often someone who doesn't over-identify with a waiter. A waiter's kind of a day job. They want to do something else, right? So here's my example. I want to know if this could be considered a different example of bad faith. So you have a waiter in LA, right? And whenever anyone asks them what they do, they say they really are an actor, mm-hmm. right? They're just waiting on tables now. But in truth, they haven't been in anything in a very long time. Their agent has stopped returning their calls a long time ago. They've even stopped slipping their headshot in with menus when producers show up at the restaurant anymore. They haven't done anything towards this acting identity, but they cling to it because they don't want to admit they're just waiting tables. Is that bad faith?
I think it is, but I think it is an example of bad faith in the exact inverse sense of the waiter in the cafe. So the lie that the waiter in the cafe is telling himself is that he is not a transcendence, he is just a facticity.
Right.
I think in your example, what your waiter slash actor is saying is that he is a pure freedom.
Mm-hmm.
He's just denying the givenness of his situation. He's denying the facts that are around him and just saying, because I state that I'm an actor, I'm an actor. And
mm-hmm.
that's also a very, very, very common lie that a lot of us tell ourselves. I mean, most of us, when we're up against a deadline, right? After we didn't stay for one drink, we'll be like, oh, I know this is due at 8 o'clock in the morning, but I'm just going to knock it out tonight and it's going to be great, right? As if I am a pure freedom, you know, unrestricted by the given facts of my existence.
But, you know, Sartre himself says that these two sides are, I'm in bad faith when I say that I am what I am not. And I'm also in bad faith when I say that I am not what I am.
Right.
And so I think in the I'm just going to stay for one more drink sense, there I'm saying I am someone who I am not, namely a one drink stayer. I mean, I've never been a one drink stayer. So
you're a bitter ender.
I am a bitter ender.
Yeah, this is the exact phrase that he uses. We're always being what we are in the mode of not being it, or not being what we are in the mode of being it.
Yeah. What's interesting about the waiter in Sartre's sense, but maybe also the waiter in the sense that you, Jason, were raising, is that, as Sartre puts it, there's a weird moment here in which I know and yet I act as if I don't know, or I know and then I lie about knowing, lie to myself mm-hmm. about knowing. If lying is related to the truth, then bad faith is a weird kind of lying because something is true and I know that it's true and I say the false. That duality there is really at the heart of this structure of bad faith.
See, I think that in bad faith, lying is not about the truth. Bad faith is always about the future in a way. And you cannot tell the truth about the future.
Huh.
The recognition that I cannot say anything true or false about the future is part of the pattern of bad faith.
So help me see how the waiter in the cafe, that the bad faith there is about the future, because I don't see it so directly.
Because he's saying I have no future in which I can be other than an Applebee's waiter. I have to be this. Tomorrow I will also have to be this.
Hmm.
I mean, that's the anxiety producing part of it, is that tomorrow we don't have to be anything. We don't even have to be.
Hmm. Yeah.
Rick's having an existential crisis right now on the podcast.
No, I'm just trying to, what I want to say, and I'm just trying to think if there's a necessary difference here, isn't it that when I am in bad faith, I act as if I am outside of time or without time? And that could be the future, right? So I'm outside of the present. Sartre says at one point that I'm affirming that I am what I have been. and I'm denying that I am what I have been. And those are both ways of standing out of time that are part of bad faith. And I guess once I'm outside of time, there is, in an odd way, a kind of permanence to it, right? So if I am a waiter and I'm acting as if, in saying that, I am outside of time, that will mean that within time, I am always just a waiter, like a table is always a table. So I thought I disagreed, but I think I don't in the end. I don't know. I'm just wondering if the outside of time is more basic than the futural nature of it.
I don't quite see the outside of time dimension. I think in as much as we are always making choices, the most fundamental of which is to continue making choices, continue on, that I'm in time and I'm future oriented. Even when I lie to myself, I'm not sure that the lie doesn't still involve that basic structure, becoming, not being what I am in the mode of being it, or being what I am in the mode of not being it.
Does the date example help with this time question?
How so?
I was asking. I was literally asking.
If you're asking, then you must see a way in which it is.
So the other example is a woman on a date, and she doesn't want the relationship to go anywhere, but she's enjoying being on the date. So she's kind of trying to act as if there's no telos or no direction this is going in, which is all fine if things stay nice and casual. But then there's a moment where her date holds her hand and she has this choice. She can either pull her hand back and say, like, I'm not really that into you. This is not really going anywhere. Or she can embrace it. That would be also a bad thing. So she kind of leaves her hand there as if she doesn't notice that he put his hand on her, right? Which is, in some sense, an attempt to avoid the choice that she has to engage with this. I mean, in my reading, it's a kind of bad faith that acts as if moments of facticity do not in themselves add up towards something in selecting them again and again. That you can't just keep dating someone without it going somewhere. Someone's eventually going to ask, you know, where is this relationship going?
Yeah, I agree with you, Jason. I think that the example of the woman on the date is clearly a story about someone who believes that she has the capacity to choose to not choose. Mm-hmm. Even though, of course, we all know, I mean, we've seen it on the street when somebody tries to hold someone's hand and they neither hold the hand back nor pull their hand away. We're just going to leave it there like a dead arm.
Right.
That is making a choice, right?
Right.
We know what the message is there. But I think that the woman on the date is exhibiting bad faith, like that example that you gave earlier about the waiter actor. I think that she's acting like she's a pure freedom, that she's unrestricted by the givenness of her situation and in some ways is so free that she's free to even not make a choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but at the same time, he points out that when she leaves her hand like a dead fish in his hand, what she's also doing is treating herself in terms of embodiment as a thing in the world.
Yeah.
And so then, in a sense, she's like, oh, look at that hand over there as if it's not her hand.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
I guess what I had in mind, and Jason, you're right, it does come up in the discussion of the date, and I'll just quote it. Sartre says, let us note finally the confusing syntheses which play on the nihilating ambiguity of these temporal ecstasies, right? So standing out of time. Affirming at once that I am what I have been, the man who deliberately arrests himself at one period in his life and refuses to take into consideration the later changes, and that I am not what I have been, man who in the face of reproaches or rancor dissociates himself from his past by insisting on his freedom and on his perpetual recreation.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what I had in mind when I was talking about the outside of time in general. But I think you're right, Lee, that he goes on very quickly to go back to this issue of what is a being like that is a being who is constantly making itself.
Mm-hmm.
And there then, I think because it's becoming, will always point to a futurity. So yeah, I see the point here.
There is one other example that he gives about patterns of bad faith, and that's this example of, I'm going to say the homosexual and his friend, although the word that's technically used is the pederast and his friend. Maybe we should just address that right here.
Well, yeah, he uses both terms, actually.
Yeah.
And the example is the homosexual denying that he is a pederast.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just start out by saying, I find this entire example objectionable. And I think it goes against the very idea of bad faith that Sartre has been developing in this section. Mm-hmm. Sartre acts as if this is an example of bad faith because the homosexual can't but be a pederast. You know, he talks about the waiter and he quickly says, no, here I'm not referring to or worried about the ways in which these are social stereotypes or social roles, but I'm thinking about these as elements of bad faith. And here he's trading entirely on a stereotype.
Yeah.
And I think that this example itself is in bad faith.
I agree with you. I'm wondering if you guys would allow me to try to recuperate this example and leave the pederasty out of it.
Yes.
Okay. So I can imagine this actually being a pretty helpful example of bad faith if we just made the homosexual a homosexual. So let's say we've got two guys, they're friends, they're named Rick and Jason. And for as long as Jason has known Rick, Rick has always had relationships with other men, sex with other men, romantic desires towards other men. But Rick has never said to Jason, I am a homosexual. That's the scenario.
Right.
So Rick and Jason go out one night for drinks and they're hanging out and they're talking about things. And Jason says to Rick, look, Rick, it's 2024. Nobody cares. Just admit that you're gay. Just say it. I am a homosexual. And Rick says to Jason, dude, that's so offensive. I'm not a homosexual like a table is a table. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a medievalist. I'm a Chicagoan. I'm a son of a family of steelworkers or pipe layers or whatever it is that Rick always says he is, right?
Pipe layers.
Whoops, that's a little Freudian there, but go on.
Okay, stay with me though. Okay, so that's the scenario. And I think here we could actually see almost two instances of bad faith. On the one hand, Rick is right that Jason is treating Rick like Rick is a homosexual, like a table is a table. So now we're back to the waiter in the cafe thing. Like Rick is not a homosexual, like a table is a table, any more than the waiter in the cafe is a waiter, like a table is a table. However, I also think Rick is in bad faith in a similar way to the woman on the date is in bad faith, that he thinks that his freedom is so pure, so absolute, that he can just deny the facts of his situation, right? I mean, yeah, okay, you're a lot of things, but you're not so free that you can just decide that having only same-sex relationships is not the very definition of what it is to be a homosexual. It's not, you know, the meaning of what it is to be a homosexual. So I think there's two really interesting examples of bad faith there. I also think the other problem is today in 2024, we're no less settled on the question, is somebody a homosexual like a table is a table, or is it a choice, mm-hmm. right, than they were in 1950 when Sartre is writing this book.
But I think, Lee, your reframing of the example points to a really important aspect of this question of bad faith. Because in my saying, I am not a homosexual like a table is a table, I'm not just denying my own being in itself. I'm also denying that I have made decisions over and over and over yeah. again that have brought me to who I am and what I am and where I am right now. And I'm sort of like, oh, but that wasn't me.
Yeah, yeah.
This is me now, as if I could choose that that wasn't me. Like the one who stayed to the bitter end wasn't me. Yeah. But the one who's saying I'm only going to have one drink is, you know, like starting now, this is me.
That really gets to the heart of why this section on bad faith is so important to Sartre, because ultimately any pattern of bad faith is going to be a way of fleeing responsibility. Mm. And fleeing responsibility is always going to be a way of denying that we are the kinds of beings that we are. We are absolutely free, which means that we're also absolutely responsible, but we are in a given situation, factical situation, right, with other freedoms. Mm.
We love that you join us here at the Hotel Bar for our boozy, brain-powered philosophy podcast, but we get a little tired of talking amongst ourselves here in a virtual bar. So if you'd like to pull up a stool beside us, and also beside other listeners in our Hotel Bar Sessions community, sip, share, and talk with us. follow us on Twitter at Hotel Bar Podcast. There you can also find the Twitter handles of all three of us co-hosts. For our more senior listeners, we're also on Facebook. All of our episodes are on YouTube, and from time to time, we, that is Lee, by the way, even make an appearance on TikTok. You could go old school and email us at any time at hotelbarpodcast@gmail.com, or you can visit our interactive page at hotelbarpodcast.com. If you have any feedback or you have ideas for episodes or you want to rant or rave about us, we have a designated reader for those messages who is mostly only a little tipsy. Who knows? Your suggestion could help us keep intellectual insights on tap and on the air.
There's just one last example that Sartre gives that he doesn't really explicitly frame as a pattern of bad faith, but I think is an example of a pattern of bad faith. And I just like to talk about it here because I think, especially right now, given the mental health crises that are going on in all generations in this country, that it's a really important thing to talk about. And that is this example of sadness. So again, I'm going to kind of tweak the example a little bit, but it's important to just say here at the outset that what Sartre is really questioning is the manner in which we talk about our feelings, we talk about our emotions as if they are something that happened to us, right? That there's no freedom or choice in our emotional states. The way that I present it to my students is I say, you know, imagine that this morning you woke up and you got a telephone call and whatever it was the saddest news you've ever heard, the worst news. And you were incredibly distraught, incredibly upset. But for whatever reason, you decide you're going to come to class today anyway. So you come into the room and you're sitting here and you're crying. You're visibly distraught. And as the time for class gets closer, other people start to enter the room. What would you do? And most students will say, well, I'd suck it up. Like I'd suck it up for 50 minutes and pretend as if I'm not sad or something. I love the way Sartre says it. He says, I'd make an appointment to meet with my sadness later. But I think Sartre wants to point to that as an example of the way that we do in some ways choose our emotions. They're not just things that happen to us. That we choose to engage in a project of being sad or engage in a project of sucking it up and not being sad. And, you know, students will always say, oh, but you're still sad. You're just covering it up. And that gets complicated because what does that even mean? Like, what is sadness without the expressive part of it? Kind of doesn't make sense. But even if it wasn't, you know, I'm just suppressing my sadness. Let's say you're sitting in a room and you're distraught and, I don't know, the room catches on fire or a shooter walks in the room. You're going to stop being sad and you're going to start being afraid. You're going to make a choice about the kind of emotional project that you're going to engage in. And for that reason, it's an important semi-example of bad faith because we do blame our emotions for things in the same way that the waiter blames his job, as if it's just happening to me. There's nothing I can do about it. I don't have any freedom in this. Now, let me say, we're talking about garden variety emotions here. We are not talking about clinical depression. Right. That is an entirely different thing that has to do with your physiology and chemistry and neurology. And I'm sure everybody knows this, listeners, but like the worst thing that you can say to somebody who's clinically depressed is just choose to be happy, right? Don't do that. But if we're just talking about garden variety emotions, I think he's got a good point because you do hear a lot of people say, well, what did you expect me to do? I was angry. I couldn't help it. I was sad. I couldn't help it. I was in love, you know, and that's bad faith, I think.
Yeah. And I think one aspect of this is that Sartre wants to point out that for those who want to say, no, 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 you are sad. You're just not aware of it. He asks the question, so what's the difference between sadness and the awareness of sadness?
Yeah.
And it seems like we can't make a distinction between that because the person who is sad but not aware of it, strangely, is very much like the one who is not sad. The fact that the awareness of it is part of the emotion is where the issue of decision and project emerges. I can engage in a project of not being aware of it. And therefore, it's difficult to say. I'm sad just like the person who is sad, except entirely different.
Yeah, and being sad is not like being green.
Right.
You know, there are lots of different ways to be sad. I can engage in the project of being sad in many, many, many different ways, and they're not all the same. But the sadness doesn't just happen to me like a virus happens to me or something.
Mm-hmm.
But Lee, you've been talking a lot about the centrality of responsibility in this question of freedom. And earlier, I thought you said it's not moral responsibility. And I'm wondering, could we talk about what kind of responsibility is going on here if it's not moral responsibility, or is it moral responsibility?
What I wanted to say was, I don't think acting in bad faith is all by itself a moral failure. Like, I don't think that there is such a thing as good faith. Mm. For Sartre, acting in good faith would be also in bad faith. He actually uses this example of sincerity. Yeah. I mean, sincerity is to say, like Popeye, I am what I am, and that's all that I am. And of course, that's also in bad faith. You are not. You have to keep choosing to be what you are. So that was what I wanted to say just about acting in these patterns of bad faith. I don't think that they're moral failures. I think that they're just a consequence of being the kinds of beings that we are. However, all examples of bad faith, I do believe, are a way of avoiding responsibility. Mm. And I think that that's where we have to go back to this notion of absolute freedom being so important to Sartre, because if our freedom is absolute, then our responsibility is also absolute. That is a much harder thing to reckon with.
Talk about vertiginousness.
Exactly, right? I mean, we want to say that we're, for example, not responsible for things that we weren't the primary actor in, or I can't be possibly responsible for things that I don't even know about. But we are. I mean, right now, somewhere in the world, well, somewhere here in Memphis, there are children who are starving. And I think you both would agree that we believe children's hunger is a hugely important thing, like more important than a philosophy podcast. Mm. But the fact is, all of us got up today, and at the time that we were supposed to meet, we turned on our Zoom and sat ourselves in front of the microphones, and we started talking about Sartre with one another. And our choices demonstrate that we think this is more important than hungry children, because we could have made different choices, right? I could have said, we're not podcasting today. I'm going to go find hungry children and feed them. I can't say that I'm not responsible for the choices that I didn't make. Every time I say yes to one thing, I'm saying no to every other thing. This is an example Derrida gave one time when he was talking about feeding his cat, I think. Like, it's like, every time I say yes to my cat, I'm saying no to every other cat, right? Not to mention children.
I wish I had words to describe the face that Jason was making as you were saying that.
What, the cat?
No.
No, the starving children thing. I mean, part of the issue for me is, even if you did, with the best intentions, try to resolve the issue of childhood hunger, even in the immediate, you wouldn't know where, how to go. You might not be able to do anything other than briefly ameliorate the problem. This is always, to me, the Sartre question. A lot of philosophers were like, part of the problem is how to reconcile two different books. And for me, it's always Being in Nothingness and The Critique of Dialectical Reason, where Sartre wants to talk about social structures and the way we're situated in the practical inert, and wants to reconcile his idea about absolute freedom with some understanding of social relations. And to me, that's always been the lingering problem for how to think about Sartre. I mean, I do think bad faith is a very useful concept for thinking about the way in which facticity is not all we are. And every time we say that, we're in some sense engaging in a certain kind of bad faith. And also, freedom is not what we are. That dialectic I totally agree with, but I'm not sure if I agree with the idea that we can all think responsibility in that way without thinking a lot more about what it means to exist in and through social relations.
I don't think that these two things need to be reconciled. I think when I'm talking about social relations, superstructural elements, I'm talking about how problems are made and solved. When I'm talking about my responsibility, I'm just talking about whether or not I'm saying yes or saying no to helping a problem or even identifying a problem. To say that you personally couldn't have made any choices that would have, I don't know, stopped the invasion of Gaza or fed all the hungry children in the world. Well, yeah, of course I couldn't. But my ability to solve a problem is not the determinant of whether or not I'm responsible for saying no to doing anything at all, which I am doing right now. And I could have made different choices mm-hmm. to do something. And I think that the choices that I'm making are choices that I can say yes to. I think education is important. I actually think podcasting is important. I think taking care of my cat is important. I think those are things that I can say yes to. But I know that I am a finite being. I can't say yes to everything. But I can't say that I'm not responsible for the things that I say no to.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if the sense of absolute responsibility comes very close to a notion of not being responsible at all. In other words, if I am absolutely responsible, then it's like the air we breathe. And in that sense, I'm not particularly responsible. I'm not peculiarly responsible. And so then I'm wondering if it doesn't shade toward meaninglessness.
Well, I would say the same thing that Sartre says about absolute freedom. To say that you're absolutely free doesn't mean you can do anything you want. It means there's no point at which you're not free. Absolute responsibility doesn't mean that you can fix everything that you want. It just means there's nothing about which you are not responsible.
No, I get that.
I don't see how that's evacuated of meaning.
Well, in the sense that I don't know at that point what it actually means to be responsible.
That you have to make choices. If I know that there's nothing about which I am not responsible, that means all of my choices are important. That's more concrete than saying your responsibility is only for those limited set of things that you can actually do something about, or that you tell yourself that you're responsible for, or you were the immediate cause of, or something like that. That limited sense of responsibility seems not really responsible. Because as all of these examples of patterns of bad faith demonstrate, I can always just shrug it off. I can always just give an explanation of how I wasn't responsible. But responsibility is always knocking at the door, right? Like, we've always got to say yes or no. Here's what I would say. I'll say this to listeners, but also to you guys.
Good, because we're here.
If anybody took one day, one entire 24-hour period, and kept a tally, or, you know, kept a running count of the number of things that you do in a day, that if somebody asked you, why are you doing this? You would say, basically, because I have to, right? And then at the end of the day, look at that list and say, why am I saying yes to a lot of things that I don't really want to do, that aren't meaningful to me, or that aren't projects that I want to engage in? And then say, you know what? Tomorrow, I'm not going to do that. Or I am going to do that, but I'm going to recognize that I'm choosing this thing. I'm not doing this because I have to. I'm not doing this because I don't want to starve to death. I mean, I don't want to starve to death, but I'm choosing to not want to starve to death, right? And, you know, I'm choosing to do this. Imagine how different your life would be. And it seems to me that that is the fullest sense of responsibility, that I take responsibility for every yes and every no that I choose. And I don't simply say things are happening to me. That's a profound sense of responsibility.
Yeah. Put in that way, though, no, never mind. I was just about to say something that I just chastised a student yesterday for saying.
It's all subjective.
No, that's good in theory, but it can't work out in practice.
Boo. That's bad faith.
No, I mean, my point is that if every single decision is equally decisive, and if, in fact, I cannot live without decisions, all of which are equally decisive, then I guess the way to put it is, aren't we in the dark of night when all cows are black? Decision, it's like the air we breathe. Yeah, in one way, it's the most fundamental thing and it's really crucial. And on the other hand, it's the most meaningless thing and the least crucial thing, just because it's absolutely necessary and nothing else I do can go on without it. It becomes the least important thing to me.
Yeah, like the air you breathe?
Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
But that's the most important thing to you. Like, because it's there all the time. It's literally how you be, how you are.
Exactly right. Because it's the most basic thing, it's the one thing that has to be given, and therefore it, in a way, doesn't matter to me. Like, it never occurs to my consciousness. It's never part of what I do to think about and worry about the air.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think what Sartre would say is, but it should be. It should be the fact that we think about our responsibility, that we think about how pervasive and ubiquitous and absolute it is. And not thinking about it is part of our, honestly, psychological survival habits of just trying to slough off responsibility. I suppose as a broader point, what I would say is that I would be suspicious of any moral theory that is looking for ways that we are not responsible to limit our responsibility instead of expand.
And what's also interesting, especially in relation to an episode that has come out recently on psychoanalysis, Sartre points to something like the unconscious as precisely this move that you're pointing to, Lee. We like to go to the unconscious to say, yeah, but I'm not responsible for that. You know, if it's unconscious, that's like the id, you couldn't say table more clearly than to call it it.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really interesting part of his argument, that psychoanalysis could, in the end, just be a way to try to avoid understanding the responsibility that we in fact have.
Yeah.
It's not me. It was my unconscious. Or the, not even mine, the unconscious. Bartender thinks that we all are in bad faith or maybe even just full of shit. So we are going to have to end this, but I don't think, Lee, we can end this without recognizing that this is going to be our last episode with Jason, who has made a decision that he is not a podcaster like a table is a table. And I just wanted to say before we let this moment pass that I, Jason, have really enjoyed our weekly conversations and getting to know your process of thinking more than I knew in the past. I only saw products of it. I didn't see how the sausage was made. And it's been a real joy to think along with you for this time. And I, and I'm sure we, are certainly going to miss you.
Yeah, I'm really going to miss you, Jason. I think that this was such a serendipitous find when we found you, because you really have just slotted yourself right into these conversations. I've learned so much from you. If I could just, you know, go back to a fond memory. I remember right at the very beginning, maybe halfway through the first season, you saying something like, you guys have your thing, like, Rick's always going to talk about having just taught Descartes, and you're always going to deconstruct something. And like, I need to know what my thing is. And now we know it's Spinoza. It's Spinoza and work. But this has just been absolutely fantastic. Listeners, Jason's not leaving. He's still staying on the team. I'm really excited about the things that you're going to be doing with your activist life. And yeah, I'm really going to miss you, Jason.
Well, thank you so much. I'm going to miss it too. And I think, you know, this is the other part of freedom, is we do have to make choices. And any choice worth making is always going to have some regret, because there's always the possibility that I could have kept doing this. And, you know, I don't get to talk about bad faith in this sort of way or have these sort of conversations. And I always learn something in every conversation about both how you think or how the world is, and learn something about the limitations of my own ways of approaching things. So it's been truly great. But I do have to say, I want to tell this Sartre anecdote that I can't not tell. And you can cut it.
No.
It might not be necessary. So there's this book called Modern French Philosophy, I think, by Vincent de Combe.
Oh, yeah.
In which he gives a pretty scathing summation of being in nothingness. He says, at the end of 600 pages, we learn little about being and nothing about nothingness. Okay, so I read this book a long time ago, but I was like, damn, that is such a burn. I remembered that for years. And then a few years ago, maybe even less, maybe within the last year, year and a half, someone was on Twitter. They were talking about great put downs and reviews and so on. And so I said, well, here, I just typed this one out. Vincent de Combe in this book says this, and I'll always remember that. And guess who liked it on Twitter?
Jean-Paul Sartre.
No, Vincent de Combe.
I think that's bad faith.
I bet he has a backyard full of hatches just like me.
We can talk about the bad faith of, you know, Google searching yourself, or what do they call it? Ego searching yourself.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how that fits into bad faith, but if I can't tell that story now, I'm not sure when I can tell that story.
Well, it's been a great run, Jason, and we look forward to continuing to work with you in the future. But next season, We're going to be back for season 10 with a brand new co-host, hopefully, and a whole new set of podcast episodes.
Lee, when you talked about hatchets, I thought that we should open a store in which, like, you could sell Lee Johnson branded hatchets with glow-in-the-dark handles so that you could find them sticking out in the dark, and that I could put a recording of Julia Kristeva covers Prince. But listeners, you know we don't do that. Instead, we rely on your support. And I'm going to ask you to support us in a unique way this time. Go on your podcast app and review us, but tell, let's say, 5 people about how much you enjoy the podcast. That would be a great way to support us. And of course, we have the Patreon page, but it would be really great if you could just say, hey, I like this podcast.
Well, for the final time with Jason, au revoir.
Yes, and great listeners for you too. Thanks for having me.
Aww. See you, Jason.